Hi, this is Podsafe UK. I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan.
Burnham's on the bounce. Labour finally leads in the polls for the first time in over a year, 4 points ahead on reform. Is it the indie dad to the rescue?
But Andy's popularity isn't the only thing on fire. As the UK enters our fourth heat wave this year, it's David against Goliath in southwest France and Spain as wildfires force hundreds of thousands to evacuate. While in the Cairngorms, Dovestone and Rhinegoth still ablaze over here. So we are truly in the climate catastrophe.
And we're extinguishing the wrong thing. In this case, it's the humanities. Thousands of job cuts at universities are creating regional cold spots and risking the closures of departments across the country. It's another cheery episode.
So we have got a jam-packed episode this week, but we just wanted to take a second to reflect on this polling that Labour is finally, by only a few percentage points, let's not get carried away, but nonetheless, is outranking reform. How do we feel about this? How are we feeling about a week and a half of Andy Burnham as Prime Minister?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the important thing is Luke Trill from More in Common has shared the latest voting intention, which has shown Labour moving ahead by 4 points, which again, might not seem like a huge amount, but it's the first lead since March 2025 and their highest share of the poll since November 2024. It's the first time Reform has not led the tracker since April 2025. Not great news for the Green Party, is their lowest share of the vote since October last year when Polanski became leader. Is this Burnham or is this Farage? I think that's this kind of interesting question to ask. Nigel Farage has sort of had, certainly in the context of his wider political career, a difficult month. I think that, you know, I think that this 5 million quid from Christopher Harborne is starting to stick. I think the questions about George Cotterill are starting to stick. And I don't think this kind of, this move of calling the by-election has been portrayed as, you know, has come across as the kind of swashbuckling manoeuvre that he thought it would be politically. I think what it's looked like is he's kind of desperately flailing and now he's in a literal bin fight.
I think the bin is a really big
Cal
factor
bin
face in
this. Is a big factor in this,
yeah,
for sure.
I mean, like the gimmickiness of it, the ridiculousness of it has pushed this by-election, which was absurd, let's be honest, into the front of consciousness in how they're thinking about Nigel Farage and how he operates. It's weird, as I was coming into the studio today thinking about how we would talk about this section, I had like a little bit of nervousness because I think, understandably, as progressives, we have to be critical and one could say that maybe cynicism is our default position, not for unreasonable reasons as well. And so I'm almost reluctant to say that there's been things that Burnham has done that I have been pleased by. But there have been. I mean, there's been plenty that I've not been pleased by, which we will talk about in the show, not least about some of this conversation around oil licenses and drilling. But I don't know if you saw that piece saying that he had appointed people from the Socialist Campaign Group. Did you see that?
No.
So, you know, because he keeps talking about going back to the old Labour Party. And we've talked a lot about the broad church, right? And we know that the soft left has definitely had a hearing in this new Burnham government. I mean, look, the people that are appointed is the lowest level, but nonetheless, they have been appointed, having previously been out in the cold. And there was a part of me that was like, I did not see that coming. I genuinely didn't see it coming. And, okay. I'm listening.
I think that there's two things that he has done that Starmer didn't do. And I think, firstly, in the years to come, it'd be worth reflecting on the kind of legislative inertia of the first 6 months of Starmer's time as Prime Minister. There was such stagnation in a period of time where a British Prime Minister is arguably at their most powerful. That is such a squandered opportunity by Starmer. So Burnham is doing some stuff. You know, I think that the announcement on helping give people breathing space on their bills, the VAT cut on pubs and restaurants is a big thing. Bus fares freezing is really important. Also, the second thing is he's doing something. He's also telling people what he's doing as he's doing it. And he is communicating. He's using TikTok and Instagram and other forms of social media to actually communicate what he's doing at every stage, which is sort of an important part of, you know, in a media ecosystem, which is essentially set up to sit in hostility to progressives. You've got to exploit it where you can. And yeah, so he is communicating what he's doing to the public as he's doing it. I think it's still early days, and I think he is also benefiting from both the Farage bounce, and he's also benefiting from, you know, I think a pretty stupid and avoidable error that Zach Polansky made, where, you know, they accepted an Instagram collaboration on a series of photos, one of which featured a guy wearing a T-shirt that sort of made some kind of suggestion that they were going to hang Nigel Farage. Now, obviously, that's not great. Regardless of your political beliefs, the incitement of further political violence is not great. I think once again, we end up in this situation where, you know, we see a kind of double standard we see a scrutiny deficit. So, you know, I've seen a lot of kind of hand-wringing about whether Zach Polansky... So from my personal view is that Zach Polansky and the Green Party can be too trigger happy on social media, and that there is a balance to be struck between communicating what you're doing via social media and maybe just being too online and being too quick to post. That I think that is a really important lesson that the Greens are going to have to learn, you know, as they're trying to present themselves as a genuine, serious and viable party of government. But it's also true that, you know, reform councillors have suggested that we fill potholes in with Nigerians.
It's so galling.
After Joe Cox was killed, Nigel Farage literally gave a speech where he said, we have delivered Brexit without a shot being fired. I wish there was this same pressure and scrutiny applied to the reform councillors, many of whom still have their jobs in spite of the appalling things that they've said.
I'm really glad you brought up Zach Polansky, because some of the commentary I've seen has suggested that, oh, you know, him and the Greens and their eco-populist message is irrelevant now because you've got Andy Burnham in and he's willing to talk the language of the soft left and even possibly even beyond that. He's also open to cross-party collaboration. Certainly in social care, he's been talking a lot about that. But I'm not convinced that now the Greens are irrelevant. I feel that actually having a prime minister who is willing to listen makes their message even more potent and potentially even more powerful. A really good area for challenge is on rent. Angela Rayner has ruled out rent controls. I mean, I look at the numbers of people in major cities paying up to 40% of their income to, I mean, it just doesn't make sense to not look at some rent stabilising measures. And the Greens are really pushing that. So I think that's really, really interesting. I do just want to come back to this because I was reflecting on it on the train whilst observing everyone in a heat wave acting weird. About this idea of, like, at what point are you allowed to be hopeful? Does it make you naive to be hopeful? Does it imply that the system is neutral and you just put your guy in and everything will be fine, which we know is not true? I guess my overall question to you is, how are you feeling right now about the state of British politics?
You know, my concern about Farage has still not gone away, because I don't think I'll believe... He is like Boris Johnson. Like, Farage and Boris Johnson occupy this sort of rarefied air where they essentially seem to do things two or three times a week that would be career enders for other politicians. And I didn't believe that Johnson would go until I saw the back of him. Mm. And I won't believe Farage is gone until I've seen
him. Let's be clear here. Yeah. Like, the threat of Nigel Farage has not gone away. And Andy Burnham is no saviour. Yeah. I completely get that. If anything, I think that increasingly I'm thinking that this, our emphasis on these two individual men is almost missing the point, because obviously we're looking at a far right network that's been backed by all sorts of fossil fuel money and all this sort of business. I'm trying to not be naive, but some of the things are all right.
And it is a point of interest. It does show you, it does sort of show you what it looks like when you have somebody that's actually willing to do something. And I think it is really important that political leaders show that there are levers that they can pull that can directly impact. You know, the energy bills freeze is going to directly benefit people.
Yeah, and obviously we want more, but it's not the point. The bus fare,
to show people, because I think part of the problem of the sort of initial era of summerism was it made people, it further depressed people and made people further convinced that you couldn't actually change anything. The sort of acid test of all of this is going to be the budget in the autumn, because that is going to tell us how he's going to pay for these measures. That's the real moment where we'll understand what a Burnham government looks like, because the nature of your politics is defined by two things when you're a government. It's what you do and how you pay for it.
Yeah. And there's areas that we really have no clue about. LGBTQ rights, where is he going to stand on that? Where is he going to stand on
Absolutely.
Trans rights? What we suspect about immigration is probably something that, given this podcast, we're not going to be satisfied with. But I'm glad you mentioned Starmerism, because have you seen Starmer's farewell video on TikTok?
I mean, it's inexplicable. It's inexplicable. It's worth going and looking, because again, like, it's almost like he's done it to help Andy Burnham. Maybe this is an act of supreme generosity, because Burnham's getting a lot of credit for his TikTok and Instagram game, especially, I think, in direct contrast to his predecessor. And it's almost as if Starmer has reminded people of how poor a communicator he was. So he has a Fast and Furious themed exit video. The end of one of the Fast and Furious movies, there is a scene at the end where... It's Wiz Khalifa, right? It's playing. That's the one. That's the one. Yeah, that is absolutely, that's bang on. And Vin Diesel and Paul Walker drive off in separate. It's a sort of unusually classy move for a Fast and Furious movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's emotional.
So in the video, the door of number 10 is pasted over the face of Paul Walker while Keir Starmer Vin Diesels his way out of 10 Downing Street.
Yeah.
It's unfathomable.
And the idea is, because Vin Diesel, you know, Dom Toretto, he does it all for his family, doesn't he, really? He's actually a really decent guy. And this motif is him saying, okay, we're separated, but, you know, your values are still in my heart. You'll always be a part of me. And I think what Keir Starmer's trying to say was that being Prime Minister was an honour and a privilege. It will always be a part of me. I'll always really care about this. But, I mean, ultimately, it was a picture of a door, so that was sort of weird.
Either that or he's saying number 10 is dead and I'm Vin Diesel. Hard to say. Hard to know. And that sort of gets to the nub of it. What you want from political communication is clear messaging. What you don't want is to end up leaving people going, wait, hold on. He's Vin Diesel and Downing Street died.
I mean, you know, if anything, at least he was generous to the social media person on their last day. The person doing the Keir Starmer TikTok, it was their last day. Go at it, mate. Go for it. Do the Fast and the Furious. So after the break, we'll be speaking to Simon Clark about the climate crisis. But before we go, you hear from us every week. So we want to hear from you now. So you know the drill. Our audience survey is live. We'd love for you to fill it out.
Thanks to those who've already responded. Keep it coming, guys. We love reading your ideas. And we're also sorry to those who found out that Dale Winton had died because of last week's plug. I'm really sorry. I thought that was wider knowledge. So, sorry. R.I.P. Dale Winton. Genuine icon of our childhoods.
So, give us your manifesto for the podcast. What do you want to see more of from us? What do you like? Do you want bonus bits? Do you want some behind the scenes? Do you want merch? Do you want us to bring back characters from the PSUK universe, like Chicken Nug Nugs?
Chicken Nug Nugs was an early commenter on the first few episodes of the podcast, and we discussed a lot of things that Chicken Nug Nugs.
And I haven't heard from Chicken Nug Nugs for a while, and I am genuinely worried.
Is it possible that Chicken Nug Nugs changed their name on the and is still continued to comment?
Maybe.
And engage?
If you're out there, Chicken Nug Nugs, let us know you're okay.
It was different. In an era of the podcast where we used to refer to Chicken Nug Nugs a lot, and we somehow managed to get YouGov to commission a poll on how you sit down on a chair. Do you sit hard or soft? That was a lot of what was going on. Would you like to see us bring that back? What stupid polls would you like us to somehow force YouGov into conducting?
I just realised how serious we've become. Well, that's a point for us. So listen, if giving feedback...
We haven't been that serious. Bearing in mind that just in a sort of BTS move, we've actually recorded the main interview that we're about to throw to.
Yeah, because we're Christopher Nolan.
We've recorded it out of sync. We've, in tribute to Nolan's structural rejig in The Odyssey, we've run it in a different order. And all I'll say is mature basin. And if that doesn't make any sense to you after you listen to the whole episode, it's because the producers edited something out. Giving feedback for fun isn't fun enough for you. Our friendly bosses, and they are our bosses in spite of what they've said, at Crooked have sorted a prize draw. If you can't look inside your heart, you can look inside your wallet instead and see if it could benefit. You could get $150. You got to be in it to win it. R.I.P. Dale Winton. You can find the survey link in our show notes and on our socials over the next few weeks. do it for your favourite podcasters and us.
Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Vanta.
What's the one thing in business that's spreading as fast as AI?
AI risk.
Every new tool your team signs up for, every vendor that turns on AI features, every new integration, each one is an opportunity for something to go wrong. And most security programs weren't built for AI's pace of growth.
Enter Vanta.
Vanta is the number one agentic trust platform used by over 16,000 fast-moving companies like Synesthesia, Nando's and Granola to ensure they're always audit ready.
And now Vanta is helping companies like yours watch for the risks that show up between audits across your vendors, your AI tools, and your whole environment.
The Vanta agent works like a 24/7 GRC engineer in the background, finding issues, drafting fixes for you, and cutting vendor assessment time by up to 50%.
And Vanta saves businesses time by centralizing security processes and helping them complete security questionnaires up to 5 times faster.
Whether you're a fast-growing startup or a global enterprise, Vanta is here to help you automate your security and compliance and earn and prove trust.
Get started today at vanta.com/PSTUK.
That's Vanta, vanta.com/PSTUK. Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Hexclad.
Summer is officially here, and if you're upgrading anything this season, let it be your kitchen. Whether it's quick weeknight dinners or friends turning up at the last minute, you want cookware that can keep up.
That's exactly why we're obsessed with Hexclad. They're some of the best pans I've ever used. The thing that surprised me most is you get the performance of stainless steel with the ease of nonstick, so you're not making a compromise.
And that means proper heat control, a brilliant sear, and no spending the rest of the evening scrubbing burnt on food. They're dishwasher safe, which is very important to me, oven safe up to 480 degrees, and the stay cool handles are one of those little details you really appreciate when you're trying to act like the chef off the telly that goes from the hob to the oven.
And speaking of chefs off the telly, it's no wonder that Gordon Ramsay uses Hexclad at home and in his restaurants because they're built to last. They're metal utensil safe, come with a lifetime warranty, and with over 1 million customers and more than 50,000 five-star reviews, it makes sense that it's Ramsay's choice.
So whether you're hosting all summer long or just want to make everyday cooking feel easier, this is the upgrade your kitchen deserves. So for a limited time, our listeners get 10% off with our exclusive link.
Just head to hexclad.co.uk/PSTUK. That's Hexclad, hexclad.co.uk/PSTUK. Offer excludes bundles and other items already on sale. Support our show and tell them we sent you. Fires are still tearing through France and Spain, with over 300,000 people evacuated between those two countries. Here in the UK, we're dealing with our fourth heat wave. Scotland's had to call in military support to help tackle a wildfire that's been raging in the Cairngorms for over a week.
Meanwhile, drought has triggered hosepipe bans across England and Wales, and June's heatwave alone is estimated to have cost European grain farmers £1.7 billion.
So, is this the new normal? Joining us to unpack it is Simon Clark, atmospheric physicist, climate communicator and YouTuber, who's recently been renaming heatwaves after the fossil fuel companies responsible. We are currently in what we're calling the Chevron heatwave.
Well, this is the fourth one, right? So,
take us through the four. Take us through the fantastic four.
So far, we've been doing them alphabetically, like you've been naming winter storms. So the first one would be Aramco. Which, if anybody watched the World Cup, we were sort of plastered all over it. I think it might have been the largest corporate sponsor of the World Cup.
Yeah, it was massive. And again, just while we're on this, it is really... I would just draw people's attention to an article written by Nick Ames, who's a football journalist in The Guardian, about Aramco and the consequences of that corporation has had for bits of Texas. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail that.
I read
that piece this week, and it's really, really interesting and kind of devastating, and also fascinating because of the prominence of Aramco as a corporate sponsor. It's really worth reading.
And to me was unavoidable was when you were a lot of the time you were seeing the Aramco branding during the hydration breaks, and those hydration breaks were partly caused by Saudi Aramco. It's as if they're just flashing it up, saying, "Yeah, sorry guys, that was us. This
hydration break is brought to you by Aramco. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So if you guys hated the hydration breaks in the World Cup, you can blame the fossil fuel industry.
I'm definitely feeling great about Infantino for UN General Secretary.
Yeah, when Sepp Blatter comes out and it's like, guys, you may have taken this a bit far.
Yeah.
You know. So yes, first one would have been Aramco. Second one was the BP heat wave. Yeah. So that was May, I think, was the second one. Third one was the Chevron heat wave. Mm-hmm. We're now into the fourth one, which we haven't done a video on yet. I think partly because there aren't any recognizable companies that start with D. But, you know, the reason we started doing this is because there is research that says, like, it doesn't work from, like, it doesn't make people take them more seriously in the same way that with winter storms, we don't think that naming them makes people take them more seriously. Yeah. But it means that you are talking about them. Yeah. And you're making that link as clear as possible. Because let's be absolutely clear, these heat waves and these conditions are caused by the fossil fuel industry. Yeah. And to a lesser extent, I always feel like I have to add to that also the food industry. It's not just fossil fuels, even though that is the vast, vast part of the pie. We're also talking about food when it comes to animal agriculture through methane emissions from cows, for example. Also, the deforestation that the food industry causes when you're removing forest and rainforest to make way for grazing land, for example.
Yeah.
So it's not just the fossil fuel industry, but that's the really big part of it. And World Weather Attribution, which is based here in London, did a rapid analysis that showed the June heat wave was 3.5 degrees warmer than it would have been in a world where there wasn't any fossil fuel emissions. Like, those temperatures were almost impossible, you know, physically impossible without those emissions existing. So, you know, that's the reason why we've been naming these, because they're the people to blame.
Well, let's start with the wildfires, right? So clearly very, very intense. Valencia's regional government has described the fires as beyond firefighting capacity. And in France, officials are considering a total evacuation of Bordeaux. We spoke about this a couple of weeks ago when fires were breaking out across the UK. I mean, wildfires appear to be something that is common now. Are we prepared for this?
The UK is not prepared for it, if nothing else, psychologically. We just don't think of ourselves as a country that experiences wildfires. We had our first wildfire last year that was over, oh gosh, was it 10,000 acres or hectares, which is up in the Cairngorms, where there's currently a fire right now. It's something that I'd like to do a video on. This is one of these things where it's like, I know enough to know that I don't know enough. Okay. But I can certainly say that the UK is experiencing them more frequently. Western Europe is experiencing them more frequently. Interestingly, I saw an analysis the other day that said that the conditions when it comes... So obviously with wildfires, you need a lack of moisture, you need a spark, and then you need high temperatures, right? We don't think that the precipitation changes this summer are necessarily caused by climate change. This probably is natural variability. But on top of that, you've got these elevated temperatures.
Right, yeah.
So even though there's probably an amount of rainfall that you could explain naturally, the ground is being dried out more because the temperatures are increased. Mm-hmm. So that's the human influence. And then on top of that, you've obviously got then a spark has to come from somewhere. There has to be a human element, which can be deliberate or it can be accidental. And I think in the UK, something that if we're talking about things that we can actually do, making people aware of, well, safe practices when it comes to fires and barbecues, because I don't think the average person could tell you what safe practice is or where it's safe to or to not start a barbecue. It's something that is drilled into, I think, in places in, say, Spain or France or in, I don't know, California, for example, places where they think of wildfires as being a regular occurrence.
Australia, it's a huge part of the Australian summer.
Yeah, so, you know, within the UK, we just need to sort of catch up to that. It does speak in general to the fact that the UK has not done a very good job at all at adaptation, like actually adapting to our new reality. Where the UK has done really well is mitigation of climate change. You know, when it comes to our emissions, domestic emissions, the stuff that actually happens within our borders, that's gone down by over 50% since 1990. And we're one of the world leaders when it comes to cutting our emissions. That's great.
Pretty good, right? Like we should
talk about that more.
It's worth talking about that more because I think sometimes in the climate conversation, I'm as guilty of this as anybody, if not more so, of just like immediately going, oh my God, we're fucked. Like, that's the immediate
instinct.
It's
an entirely understandable reaction, especially given the media ecosystem that evolved. Mm. Because within media, we're drawn to negative stories, because we're drawn to the hyperbolic and the sensational. Not to say that the situation isn't hyperbolic and sensational. Yeah, yeah. But the coverage focuses on those hyperbolic negative stories, and we don't talk about those wins. We don't talk about... Yeah, I gave a talk recently at Cambridge Net Zero Society, and this was, you know, Cambridge science students. And I think when I told them, you know, the UK's emissions have gone down by 50%, how many of you know that? probably about 10% of the room could actually say that they'd heard that before, right? We just don't hear about those positive stories. So that's great. And the way that the UK has done that is by focusing on power generation and the phase out of coal and the rise of renewables, mostly. Other factors too. But whilst we've done a great job in bringing down our emissions, we haven't adapted. And we've really seen that with these recent heat waves.
Yeah.
You know, people have not been adapting their buildings. We haven't seen... And that's not just, to be clear, air conditioning. I think when people hear heat adaptation, they think our buildings don't have air conditioning.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a part of it, sure. That's an active adaptation you can take. But there's also there's passive elements that you can do in terms of planting trees around buildings, in terms of better urban planning, heat policies when it comes to when workers need to be in the building and not be in the building, safe temperature limits for people who are working outside. These are things that exist in other parts of the world because ultimately we're moving into a climate that historically was associated with, you know, one place would be further south in Europe. Yeah. We can look to their policies to see what works and really play catch up because you can't mitigate your way out of this problem.
Yeah.
Not least because the UK is only about 1% of global emissions. Not to say that it doesn't mean it's important for us to bring that down. Everybody has to bring their emissions down. But you can't just do that. You also need to do the adaptation. And we've really seen the lack of that recently.
So the latest climate change risk assessment in 2022, which happens every 5 years, so we're due the next one next year, has said that before 2040, the chances of an above 40 degree heat wave in the UK were 0.02%.
Yeah.
That was 2022, but we're now hitting the extreme end of those predictions.
We've already hit the 40 degree heat wave in the UK, yeah.
But that's not being used to guide any planet. Like that's a bit of a concern, right? Again, worth celebrating. We've done a lot of good things in terms of decarbonising, but shouldn't that we're in the emergency now, right?
Yeah, we absolutely are.
This is the thing. We keep talking about it. We've always talked about climate change. You know, really, sort of my whole life, global warming, whatever we wanted to call it, as an abstract thing, but we're sort of in the emergency now.
We are, and there's an element of it that's sort of frogs in pots, right? That it's just the change is so slow that, you know, people don't recognise it. But what we're seeing is these rapid changes. I mean, to give you one statistic, in the past, I think it's the past 2 months, there have been 2,700 excess deaths in the UK linked to elevated temperatures in heat waves. Mm-hmm. So that's 2,700 people who have died because of a climate crisis in the UK in the past 2 months. That's if that's not an emergency, I don't know what is. And the fact that we're not reporting on it in that way, or at least, you know, some people are, people at The Guardian, for example, are treating this with the severity that it needs. But if you look across the media landscape, you do see a lot of irresponsible reporting of the heat wave. You see it being portrayed as people on the beach, people enjoying ice creams, people enjoying the park, whatever it is. And the way that we frame our reality through the media shapes how we perceive it and how we react to it, right? So, you know, if we're talking about, again, things that we should be doing, because that's what I try to focus on with my work, is being like, right, we know that this is a serious situation. What can we do about it? One of the key things is reshaping those lenses for how we frame these events. Traditional media's very guilty when it comes to, you know, as I say, framing it through ice creams and beaches and things like that.
For the love of God, don't go to the beach in a 40-degree
heat
wave.
No, what are you doing?
Please!
There is an interesting thing about the attitudes of people that come from hot countries to the sun.
Compared to the UK.
Compared to the UK. And like...
heat wave, whip tops off, go to the park.
Yeah, put your clothes on, guys.
My family in India are like, what are you doing sitting in the sun? Get out of the goddamn sun. What the hell's the matter with you?
There's an interesting knowledge transfer that goes on here, right? In that, like, Europe is the fastest warming continent in the world, right? So warming about twice as fast as the global average. And we are the continent that is responsible for this crisis, especially the UK, because we were the first country to industrialise with coal. We exported modern capitalism around the world. We built railway networks, which relied on fossil fuels, but then built these mega corporations. It's kind of our fault, really. And so while we've exported all this misery, in order to adapt to it, we now need to import knowledge from these places that are being primarily affected by it.
Yeah.
So places like India, places in sub-Saharan Africa, places in South America, there's all this indigenous knowledge that we actually now need to adapt and kind of get down onto the level of these people and say, right, how do we deal with this situation that we created? And I think there is a beautiful future in which that knowledge transfer happens and it's harmonious and the West is receptive to it, but, you know, I'm not certain that that's going
to
happen.
We don't seem to be able to see what's going on outside our window. So the UN Environment Programme originally estimated a 30% jump in extreme fires by 2050. But this cluster of extreme events in the last couple of years suggests that all of the acceleration windows are shifting forward. Yeah. And so we are in... It's here.
It absolutely is here.
You know, we've talked about predictions that were already quite doomy when they were predicted, but we're at this extreme end and where the deadline for the doom is being brought forward. What's happened with these predictions? Why have they gone wrong?
Well, it's important to say that for the most part, predictions, if you look at the average, they've been pretty good. We obviously, it's incredibly difficult to predict the future. This is an incredibly complex system because not only do you have uncertainty with emissions, you've got uncertainty in how the carbon cycle responds, so how trees respond to it in northern, temperate and tropical regions. And you've got uncertainty in what we call the equilibrium climate sensitivity. So that's if you double the CO2 in the atmosphere, where the planet will warm to. You'd think that that'd be a number that we'd have pretty well down, but actually it's active research because it's such a complicated system. So the predictions for the most part have been pretty good, but as you say, we're starting to bring them forwards. One possibility of that is that the equilibrium climate sensitivity is greater than it was, than we thought it was, combined with the fact that we've actually been reducing air pollution around the world, in particular from shipping. When we saw a big spike in warming a couple of years ago, one of the reasons that we think that happened is because there was a decrease in sulfate emissions from shipping, and basically sulfates go into the atmosphere and reflect some sunlight away. So if you strip that out of the atmosphere, which is definitely beneficial when it comes to health impacts, and also it's something that happens when you start burning less coal, because coal puts sulfates into the atmosphere. We estimate about 7 million people die every year from air pollution. So actually more people die from air pollution than smoking. So it's definitely like a good thing to be bringing this stuff down. But it does mean that more of the sun's energy reaches the planet, and that means that we warm more, right? So that's a factor in it, and that may have been masking some of that increase in the slightly higher equilibrium climate sensitivity. The honest answer is, it's a very complicated system. We don't know enough. We don't have huge amounts of data in terms of time. We've only got a couple of decades to draw our conclusions from when it comes to these really big questions. You know, the science is being done. As you said, the last assessment was several years ago now, 2022. And the next assessment is probably going to bring those timelines forward, but hopefully also shrink the uncertainty. That's certainly the hope. But the fact is we don't know how much warming. Everybody talks about warming by 2100, right? But that's probably not relevant to most people who are capable of listening to that, right? So really we should be looking at 2050. You know, how much warming are we expecting by 2050?
We got to stop talking about 2100. I think the second you say 2100, people just switch off. Yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
That's the problem of the people who are hunting replicants. Like, that's a Blade Runner issue. That's the Starship Enterprise. That's Captain Jean-Luc Picard's issue, not mine.
Yeah.
I think probably we've got to stop. We have to stop talking about 2100.
Because if you think about, like, 2050, that's people who might be listening to this podcast. Mm-hmm. Somebody listening to this could be the Prime Minister in 2050. You know, like that's policy that can be impacted by this kind of
generation. Did you hear that?
I made that bold prediction.
Stay in school.
I'm assuming that Andy's a fan of yours, right? You know,
he has been a guest on this show, but he no longer responds to emails.
It's a bit busy, guys.
I maybe shouldn't have asked him about the ethical implications of mass investment by Abu Dhabi in Manchester Property Systems. But let's get move on.
We learn.
But yeah, I think we should be talking more about 2050 and the fact that, like, at the moment we're experiencing about, because we have to remember it's like the long-term average when we talk about a temperature, we're about 1.4. This year we're going to be a bit less than 1.5 probably. Next year it could, because of the effect of El Nino, and it's a Godzilla El Nino that's being predicted, could be as high as 1.7 for that 1 year. But the long-term average, about 1.4. By 2050, you could be looking at 2. It could be less than 2. It could be a bit more than 2.
So I hear what you're saying about let's talk about the years that we will be alive for, but I actually think 2050 also feels quite far away. When today we have fire clouds, which I cannot believe I'm saying that is a phrase. That is a real thing. First of all, please could you explain it? We should lead with the fire clouds. We don't need to talk about the 25th. Yeah, let's just talk about the fire clouds.
Do you mean pyrocumulonimbus?
I believe so, yes.
So, can, so
we prefer the term fire cloud.
Yeah.
So normal, if that's what you're referring to, normal cumulonimbus clouds, which is your thunder clouds, form when there's loads of vertical movement in a cloud, lots of convective energy that happens. Over the top of a fire, you've got lots of convection already because you've got lots of hot air that's rising. And so if it's intense enough and there's enough moisture around, it can form these, basically, they're not artificial, but they are, well, they're fire-induced thunderstorm clouds, basically. Pyrocumulonimbus is just also one of my favourite names for any thing.
It's actually, I've got it written down on my laptop, and I thought, I'm not even going to attempt that.
Well, apparently these clouds have appeared in Gironde, in France.
Yep.
I find it quite terrifying that these exist.
That a fire is able to generate its own weather system, effectively.
Yeah, we have seen these before, but obviously, seeing that in association with a wildfire in Western Europe, I'm not an expert when it comes to this kinds of things, but that does seem like something I would have heard about before.
But just to be clear, it looks like a cloud, but it's got fire in it.
It's got fire underneath it.
Fire underneath it, but it's giving Sharknado energy. Yeah. You know?
It does very much have Sharknado energy, yeah.
I just feel we could lead with that over 2050. It's just my suggestion.
Before we move on to policy, let's just quickly, just to sort of round off the fire cloud section, in terms of preparedness going forward, we need to be making the public more aware about.
Yeah, the targeted policy intervention we can make is the spark. It's what creates the wildfire.
Yeah.
The conditions of the wildfire, it's obviously partly natural and it's partly anthropogenic through climate change. Ooh. But the fire only starts when there's mismanagement and there's a fire that spills out. Or, of course, if it's arson and somebody deliberately starts the fire. So I think making the public aware of safe practices, especially around barbecues.
Where are you putting out your cigarettes?
Do
people still smoke? Possibly.
I don't know. Well, to be fair, vapes can themselves explode. So please vape responsibly. Again, like I say, this is something that hopefully I'll be doing a video on quite soon. So I've yet to do the deep dive into specific recommendations. But that's the area we need to focus on.
Right, okay. So let's move on to government policy now. So reports over the weekend continuing to suggest that Andy Burnham is set to give a green light to controversial new drilling in the North Sea by approving the Jackdaw and Rosebank oil fields. You posted about this on your Instagram. What's your reaction to this? And do you think, is this just total necessity because of what's going on in Iran right now, and what's been happening with Russia and Ukraine for the last sort of 3 or 4 years?
So I think, I'm taking this with a grain of salt because I know there was intense speculation around Ed Miliband becoming Chancellor, for example.
Right.
Like there's, and we know in the past that Andy has made very clear statements around climate.
Yeah.
He's called for a fossil fuel treaty, for example. So if this does go ahead, it's going to be doubly disappointing because he's reneging on his position. But the economics, when you actually look at sort of the necessity of North Sea oil and gas, it simply does not add up. Because if you think about any energy system, it's got to be affordable, right? So the issue that we currently have is that the price of gas is too high, and it's too high because of international pressures. So if you were to get more gas to extract from the North Sea, that doesn't get sold to the UK. It goes onto the international market.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're more secure because of that. It's also not going to affect the price because the amount of gas that's left in the North Sea is minuscule. It's referred to as a mature basin, which feels like a very polite way of describing it.
It sounds like a very specific Pornhub category. I'm sorry to say, mature basin. I'm not saying I'd click on it. I'm just saying, we're not here to yuck anyone's yums.
No, far be it from me. I'm not looking at your phone after this.
My phone's clean, man.
It's going to go into the international market, and because there's so little that would be added to it, it's going to make no difference to the price, like whatsoever. So it's not going to make it cheaper. It's not going to make it more secure. It's also not going to impact anything in the next 10 years, because that's about the amount of time you need in order to actually get something extracted out of the ground and into the market.
Yeah.
So it's not going to help us in the short term. It's just going to make money for certain companies.
So why is he doing it then?
Political capital, hypothetically.
We still, we still don't know if he's going to do it. Yeah.
I mean, you could argue that this would be a olive branch to people on the political right, and it's something that's like a Mrs. Tweedy, finally something we agree on type moment. Sorry, I Chicken Run's the greatest film ever made. So that was the reference that
Chicken Run's a brilliant movie.
Jumped to.
It's a brilliant movie.
So I would guess that, I mean, when it comes to the absolute emissions of it, you know, you put it in the context of the amount of coal that China's burning, sure, it's not much, but it's disappointing. A, from somebody who has said all this stuff in the past, and B, from a country that has made such great strides when it comes to electrification. Decarbonization. And from a country that needs to be a global example when it comes to this stuff. Because that's what the UK kind of is when it comes to the decarbonization of its economy. Like, people can look to us and say, oh, that policy intervention worked. Let's copy that here. If they see us going back on that and going back towards fossil fuels, it's just incredibly disappointing, incredibly bad optics, frankly. I'm choosing to be optimistic about this. Because the other stuff that we've seen, you know, making Miliband foreign secretary, we know that he's taking up the chair on the World Bank for the UK. It's not going to a junior minister, it's actually going to him. And he has said that he's going to be pushing for international climate finance. Right. He has been pushing for, you know, the UK leading on the international stage. So it would be mixed messaging, to say the least, to go ahead with Rose Bank.
What's your read on the rumours that Andy Burnham has been influenced by the jobs argument? That actually the trade unions in particular have been in his ear about protecting jobs. So Sharon Graham, the leader of Unite, which represents workers in the oil and gas industry, has backed the new drilling, said that the commitment of the then Energy Secretary Ed Miliband to net zero was a noose around the neck in terms of job creation.
Well, I think, we absolutely cannot have a repeat of what Thatcher did to the coal mines. You know, you had, actually, the soul was sucked out of towns in the north of England, in Wales. And so if you're going to transition away from these fuels and from these industries, you need to have an alternative. It is not enough to just take these things away. And I think if that is the reason why, it's disappointing, because we know that the clean energy sector in the UK is one of the fastest growing parts of the economy. And we know that there are so many good jobs to be made. And actually, there's what we're starting to run into now is the issue of our network not being able to deal with all the renewables that are being added to it very, very quickly. So there's a need for new jobs when it comes to welding, fabrication, a lot of skills that would have been used in these industries that could be applied to clean tech instead. So I can understand why they're making that argument. But I think to just cling to fossil fuels as this is what's worked in the past, and this is what our jobs are, I think it's blinkered. It's kind of tunnel vision. But it's not enough to just negate that. You cannot just ignore it. You have to have a just transition and not leave people behind. I think one opportunity that you do see is enhanced geothermal. That's something that we don't talk about as much in the UK. It's more of an American thing. But basically, the techniques and technologies you need to extract oil and gas are exactly the same thing that you need to develop new geothermal power, because it's much the same technology. You're drilling down, you're putting water down and then pumping it back up, right? So if you want to keep those skills and those jobs alive, just do it in the energy sector in a slightly different way. But obviously, that is very dependent when it comes to the geology, which is why it's more of an American thing.
I think it's worth noting, I think it's also really important to note that according to documents from within the industry, the Jackdaw gas field would create 27 jobs.
That's what
we're talking about. These are industry documents. The Guardian reported on this a couple of weeks ago that only 27 direct full-time jobs would be created by Jackdaw. So it's really important that this is not like a kind of, this is not a job creation engine. It's not a wealth creation engine for the country. It's not an energy creation engine for the country. It's not an engine for the country.
It's to make money for these companies. Yeah. I mean, the companies, that their internal documents said, because they produced these estimates that said, this is how much oil and gas is left, this is how much money we could make. They, in that memo, said, these are not realistic assumptions.
Fuck me.
Because it's basically saying, well, if you get rid of the windfall tax and if we basically get all this investment, we can access the more difficult to access stuff. Yeah. And they were basically saying in this document, saying, well, I don't think that's realistic, guys. So it's just to make money for these companies. It's another example of these giant companies and the wealth that they have. I think, again, just to come back to it, shaping the way in which we view these issues and shaping it through traditional media and increasingly through social media as well. The fact that the algorithms on X, on YouTube, on Instagram, these are the lenses through which you view the world. They are controlled by immensely wealthy people who have vested interests, right? And they're and primarily making more money. Mm-hmm. And so they are going to tailor the news that you see in the way that it is framed, sometimes directly, sometimes covertly, you know, just through nudges here and there, but changing the way in which we see issues like this. And I think if there's a targeted policy intervention that we need, I've been banging this drum for ages now, we need more oversight into these platforms. You know, we need, yeah. we're not going to get out of this crisis without fundamentally changing our relationship with information and with news. And that means more oversight onto the content that is allowed to be on these platforms and the algorithms through which we actually receive our news. In theory, some of those are in place. The Digital Services Act in the EU now, in theory, prohibits basically misinformation. It doesn't explicitly say that, but it has to be enforced. And being a European directive and these being primarily American companies,
it's
very difficult.
But getting to the heart of, as you say, like we're talking about money and power and money that's going into our politics, lobby groups. We can have this chat around the houses around jobs. Like you're saying, there's 27 jobs. Yeah. But let's be honest about what's going on here.
Yep. And it's so nakedly the case when it comes to reform.
That's
the really obvious example. I mean, the and using every trick in the book when it comes to downplaying the severity of the crisis, shaping the conversation that we have around this. The air pollution being linked to, you know, increased warming, that was seized on by people on the political right. I think Richard Tice retweeted it saying, you know, there is no climate crisis. This is a scam. Because it was a Daily Telegraph headline that said the heat waves were caused by decreases in air pollution. Decreases in air pollution have been partly responsible for increases in warming, but that's on top of this enormous signal from the climate crisis. Yeah. Mm. And it's something that people on the political right do a lot, which is focus on one part of the truth. Because that is, it is true what he said, that there is a contribution of air pollution to these heat waves. But it is only a tiny part of it. But the fact that it is simple and the fact it's a tiny part of the truth is its strength. Because when it comes to social media in particular, the simpler your message, the more likely it is to be shared and to go viral. And people on the right get this. Like, social media is anathema to nuance. You cannot have a nuanced discussion on X. Well, I mean, that's partly because of X, but just in general, you know, the size.
You sure can't have any conversation now without being advertised like gold or a weird AI
it's
video generator.
It's honestly just Nazis in porn.
Just to return to that point, the fact that they focus on one element of the truth and ignore the vast majority of it means that they can get away with it within the way that we currently view media and the way that we currently hold people to account, because they're not technically wrong. We need to change our relationship with information and change our relationship with how simplistic the conversation is that we are having.
Yeah, this is just a sidebar, but I remember doing a TV debate and about the climate crisis, and my right-wing opponent said complete straight face it was because people built too many drives. And I was like, I felt like I'd been punched in the face. I was like, what?
Too much
driveway building.
What? Let's unpack that for a second. Yeah.
Because
I get it. Drives are bad. But really?
It's the same thing again. It's technically, because, you know, there's cement that goes into that. Cement is a couple of percent of global emissions, right? It's an inherently polluting industry. By building the driveway, you've got more cars, and that's obviously more pollution, right? So there is an element, the barest grain of truth.
It's something to do with
the albedo? The
land being turned. I don't know, mate. But
You're the science man.
I just thought it was crazy because obviously I felt it was a diversion to say that it's individual people's choices.
Oh, and that's
rather
the other
than this
massive thing.
Absolute network of big money, big power that is having influence all over the world.
Can I just make a recommendation? Anybody listening to this, go to DSmog. DSmog are investigative journalists that specialise in the climate crisis, and they have amazing resources on there for politicians, for special interest groups, for non-profits and things like that, to show you how much money is involved, where it is going, and the influence that it's had, right? So, for example, Kemi Badenoch running her campaign for being head of Conservatives from the head of the Global Warming Policy Foundation, which is like one of the leading climate sceptic groups in the UK, right? That kind of soft influence, as well as this sheer amount of money. And it's getting much more sophisticated. I think when people think about these efforts, you know, it's big oil, big ag, whatever it is, plowing money into these things, we think of big advertising campaigns or buying off politicians, whatever. But we know, for example, that they also paid for AI bots to go into local Facebook groups to chat shit about heat pumps and spread misinformation about heat pumps. Like, that kind of level of sophistication, that's the kind of thing that we're up against now.
DSmog found that between December 2019 and June 2024, Reform got more than £2.3 million from oil and gas interests, polluting industries and climate deniers. That's 92% of its overall donations in that period. The New York Times found that the party raised £4.75 million in 2024, 40% of which came from people who have openly questioned climate change or have investments in fossil fuel or other climate polluting industries.
Reform definitely started, and I think this is a really nuanced, important point, it started as the fossil fuel industry as a trench coat, basically.
Yeah. But Navarra Media called it the political arm of the fossil fuel industry.
But what's happened is they have seized on and capitalized on legitimate grievances that people in this country have. And I think a mistake that we make is just writing them off as fossil fuel shills. Mm. They are speaking to people that feel disenfranchised and feel left behind and have entirely legitimate reasons to feel that way. And we kind of ignore that at our peril, right? Like, that's the seed funding that's made this political party possible. It's going to be the rudder, but the body of the ship is now increasingly being, as it becomes more mainstream, maybe it's past its peak, the polling data seems to indicate Reform has, that the majority of the ship is made up of people with legitimate grievances. Yeah. And I feel like just saying to people, oh, you know, 92% of their funding came from the fossil fuel industry. It's very effective at hardening stances against Reform, but I don't think that's effective at changing anybody's mind who has recently started to vote Reform because they think they represent change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just before we get on to like your suggestions for what the new climate policy should be under Burnham, there was a moment where I sort of saw I saw something rise out of you, almost out of your subconscious, that I just want to briefly return to, which was Coco raised this idea of, you know, you were talking about individual responsibility versus corporate responsibility. Just briefly talk about that. What is your feeling about the framing of the climate debate as being the fault of individual people rather than large corporations or sort of systemic factors?
So this breakdown between individual and systemic is one of the massive things within the climate movement, right? And I want to be absolutely clear that pretty much anybody living in the UK has a larger carbon footprint than the average person in the world. We live in a very energy and resource intense society. And so it kind of makes sense for us. I can't remember the statistics off the top of my head, but it's something like the top 10% of the world's population is responsible for something like 70% of its emissions. It's definitely a West-centric problem. So in that sense, individualism, good. However, the concept of a carbon footprint was...
It was created by the advertising agency. It was Ogilvy and Mather, I think, for BP.
Yeah, so to basically put that emphasis on the individual and move the camera away from these systematic changes. So I think there is value in looking at it through that individual lens. You know, it's why I am vegan. I'm not a particularly good vegan. I'm veggie a lot of the time, but I try to be vegan. I don't fly. And I basically, you know, get my electricity from a responsible provider, right? It's a good frame if it means that you do take individual actions and not at the expense of systematic actions. So it means voting for political parties for, you know, for example, that aren't going to have ecocidal policies. Yeah. And, you know, to be clear, yes, individual good, systematic is the way we get out of this.
Yeah.
You cannot paper straw your way out of the climate crisis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You need to put checks and balances on banks. You need to put checks and balances on social media. We need to vote for the political parties that actually, you know, promise proper policies and then hold them to account for that. So you need both, but the systematic stuff is what we need far, far more of. And we need to stop feeling quite so much, I think, individual pressure, because that can become overwhelming. And it also means that, like I say, you can take some of those individual actions and then think, well, I've done my bit. And that means that I don't need to worry about all this other stuff that's happening in the country.
But then what do you do about America at the moment? You know, to return to Ed Miliband as foreign secretary, that's great if he's going to be, you know, if he's going to take up our seat in the World Bank. But the World Bank recently scrapped its target of directing 45% of its finance to climate-related goals under pressure from the States. Are we sort of ineffective in the face of the kind of, you know, the turbo polluter that is the United States of America?
So certainly in the face of the Trump administration, on a federal level, yes. Yeah. Like, you know, they're obviously the juggernaut in the room and they're really throwing their weight around when it comes to international organizations. They have basically withdrawn from everything they can withdraw from.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they can't hurt too much more because, you know, what more can you do than walk out of the room?
Yeah.
So within this administration, you know, very limited what we can do. However, when it comes to individual states, I can't remember the number of states, I want to say it's 28 off the top of my head, have net zero targets that they're still moving towards. It's not just about the federal stuff when it comes to America. And I think if we get free and fair elections in, 2028, and if the Democrats win, there's going to be a surprising bounce back. Obviously, there's a lot of nested if statements there. It's very conditional. But I think there is a lot of groundswell within America that knows how serious the situation is and is just going to burst through what's been the cap on it, basically, for the past couple of years. So, yes, you know, we do have limited impact. One area that the UK has a larger impact than people realise is finance. So London is one of the global hubs for international finance, and especially for financing new fossil fuel projects, for primarily underwriting new fossil fuel projects. So one area that the UK could make a massive difference is changing the regulations around that and basically preventing new extraction from being financed from the UK. That's, I think, 5% of the global total off the top of my head. So we can have an outsized impact when it comes to the financial industry. Great charity that's doing work in that is Share Action. That are doing work. They actually had a campaign recently basically getting people to write to their banks to get them to divest their pension portfolios. Because that's an area where primarily, you know, if you're talking about the impact that you individually can have financially, it is through your pensions.
It's a really under-discussed thing because I think it's really complicated and chewy. And also a lot of people, to be frank, our age, don't have pensions. But it is a really, really... It is a very under-discussed area. I'm glad you brought that up.
It's very unsexy, is the problem. Yeah. Right?
Well,
who gets excited about global finance?
Yeah, but I mean, like, if you're going to die before you retire, isn't that really eco? Because, you know, we use a lot of resources when we're alive. It's just an idea.
The best thing you can do for the planet is dying, question mark?
It's dying, question mark?
I'm not sure I can sign on to that one.
This is just, being serious, though. If you were Andy Burnham, what are like actual climate priorities beyond my just die, okay?
I'll start internationally. I think what the signal we've got from Miliband is great. Taking on a leadership role, we'd want to see that. In terms of international climate finance, the UK has in real terms cut its finance over successive governments. And whilst we've said that we've increased it or maintained it, what's actually happened is we've moved stuff that we were already doing under the umbrella of climate finance. So nothing's actually happening there. So I'd want to see him... basically undo that to increase our contribution internationally and basically trying to safeguard the Amazon, Congo rainforests in particular, because we know that they are close to, well, certainly the Amazon is close to a tipping point where if we deforest too much more, it's going to, because of a rainforest is a self-sustaining wet ecosystem.
Right? Yeah.
And so if it goes beyond a certain critical threshold, it will start dying back and it will become a savanna, which is a self-sustaining dry ecosystem.
Yeah.
We don't know where that threshold is, but we know we're pretty close to it. We know also that there's great progress being made in deforestation in the Amazon. It's down by about 50%
under
the new presidency of Lula. And elsewhere in South America, we've seen a lot of progress. So it's not a bleak, hopeless situation there. We need more finance to help with that. And I think that should be a priority. I'm actually wearing their T-shirt. This is Cool Earth, which is a
charity. For listeners.
Sorry, I am wearing a black T-shirt.
The T-shirt says Cool Earth.
which is a climate charity that works in the three biggest rainforests in the world. And what they do is offer unconditional cash transfers to indigenous populations. So these are groups that often have extreme hardships. They live in poverty. They can be dealing with disease. And they have no way of making money. They have no way of basically improving their situation. So much as they don't want to see their trees cut down, when a logging company comes in, they will offer them cash and they're the only game in town, so they take it. So what Cool Earth does is basically offer an alternative, and where they operate, 99% of the forest is still standing.
Great.
So it's an amazingly effective charity, and it's not just mitigation, it's keeping that carbon sink secure. It's also adaptation, because there are rainfall changes in these communities. They are suffering from climate change just as much. So it's mitigation and adaptation that's very effective. I would love it if Andy Burnham were to dedicate some funding to what's called cash and voucher assistance, or direct cash transfers like this, because we know they work. We know they're very effective and they can be very targeted. So when it comes to international climate finance, I'd love to see that.
We will also obviously link to that in the show notes, he says, with the confidence of a podcast host who has no idea how that process happens and has created more work for his producers.
What about domestically?
Yeah, so domestically, as I said earlier, we've done amazingly when it comes to decarbonising our power supply by phasing out coal and by building out renewables, especially wind. In fact, in the next year or two, we're going to see a huge amount more wind going onto the grid, which is going to push out gas in our electricity mix, which is going to start bringing down the price, because it's too complicated to get into now. But basically, if there's gas on our grid, it makes it much more expensive for everyone. So the more renewables you have, the less likely it is that's going to happen. And so the cheaper it's going to be. And that's certainly already in the works. We had the latest auction in response to the Iran energy crisis. We saw the latest big auction of renewables being brought forward to this year. So we should see even more wind and solar being deployed. So keep doing that, enabling that to happen, but also investing in the grid, making sure that we can actually connect these projects to the grid and investing in grid scale storage. We have it already, we just need more of it, basically. I want to see that. I'd want to see more of an emphasis placed on heating and making heat pumps and a better insulation more accessible to people, which is what we've already seen for the Warm Homes Plan, through some community energy stuff. That's great. We just need more of that. And decarbonizing transport. So that means, yes, making it easier than ever to get an electric vehicle. In fact, EVs now outpace petrol cars for the first time, I believe, when it comes to sales. You know, but making it easier to do that, yes, but also investing in public infrastructure. So when it comes, so railways, light rail, buses. The government, I don't think this is something that I've seen discussed anywhere. I only know this because a friend of mine works for First Bus in Bath. But if a bus company wants to upgrade from a diesel to an electric bus, the government pays, I want to say, 75% of the difference between those two
models.
It's a
great policy. That's a fantastic policy.
Yeah. More of that, please. Yeah. Making that more possible. Because, you know, electric cars are going to be essential for decarbonising transport, especially in rural areas where it's just not economically viable to build public services. But you need to, in cities, we need more and better and more reliable public transport. So, I mean, we know that we are effectively nationalising the railways again as these contracts run out for regional operators. So bringing them into national ownership and subsidising them, I think would be another great policy. I think I'd want to see specific policy around misinformation. So basically holding these large platforms to account. And in particular, I'd want to see a ban on fossil fuel advertising, which could be nationwide. It could be at an individual city level. But I don't want to, for example, on the tube, have to see an advert for Aramco or BP or Shell or whatever it is. Because much as there's a free speech argument, you shouldn't be stopping people from saying what they want, these are bad faith actors who have abused over and over again their ability to say whatever they want. But, you know, we know what works. Fossil Free Media is an excellent organisation to support doing that kind of work, to basically push for a ban on fossil fuel advertising.
Just quickly, because obviously Kanishka Narayan has actually been appointed as, you know, our AI minister. AI, the data centers pose a significant climate risk in terms of energy consumption, heating and water usage.
Yeah, I mean, I think the UK has really doubled down on betting on AI, and I think it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake as a creator, because you know, we don't use anything AI generated in our work. I just think it's trash. It's the surest way to turn me off your product. But also, I think it's a mistake because it's a bubble and it's going to burst. And I think all these investments are going to fall flat. And I think it's a mistake because, as you say, these data centers need electricity, they need water, they generate heat. Of course, from the heat, you can actually do district heating, as they do in Sheffield, is one example. Yeah. We need to be very, very careful about actually giving permits to these data centers. And, you know, we know that they need them near large population centers. They need them near London, Edinburgh, Manchester, all these places. If they are, I think we need to push them as much as possible for their eco-credentials to make sure that they are powered cleanly, their water is sustainable, and that basically they're not going to be a net drain on an energy grid that is going to be in increasing difficulties as we go on, because we're racing to catch up with all the renewables that we're putting on the grid.
Simon Clark, it's been great seeing out this ExxonMobil heatwave with you. Yeah. I also couldn't find a D. I did try to search.
We'll just skip D and go straight to E. The Exxon heatwave has a nice ring.
Yeah, doesn't it? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, I speak to my old friend, Dr. Peter Riley, about university job cuts threatening the humanities. But we also just wanted to do some housekeeping before we go. As we've talked about on this podcast, there are quite a few lessons we can learn from our good friends in the US of A. We can learn from their mistakes, but we can also learn from the people who are fighting tooth and nail in that country to build a more inclusive society.
Stacey Abrams is a trusted voting rights advocate in the American South. Her podcast, Assembly Required, explores solutions for fighting back against fascism and corruption.
In this week's episode, Stacey is talking with author Ben Wickler about what we can learn from heavily divided states where progressives have successfully pushed back against conservatives.
New episodes drop every Tuesday on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
PodSave the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
If you've been sitting on a business idea, Shopify makes it easy to make it happen. Everything you need to start selling is included and ready from day one.
One of the biggest hurdles is wondering what happens when someone actually wants to buy. Shopify Checkout takes care of that, helping more customers complete their purchase. And when they come back, their details are already saved. So it's one tap and they're done.
And that's the kind of thing that gives you confidence early on. So you're not worrying about the checkout working. You can focus instead on what you're creating.
And because Shopify handles the setup and selling side of things, you get more time to grow your business rather than constantly managing it.
It also helps that Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from some of the biggest brands to people launching their very first business. It's nice knowing the same infrastructure is working for everyone.
With Shopify, nothing stands between your idea and a real business. So go make it one.
Start your free trial at shopify.co.uk.
That's shopify.co.uk.
Okay, we're using movie magic for this next section, as we've also pre-recorded a conversation earlier this week. That's why you will see that it is me interviewing Dr. Peter Riley from Exeter University in a different place wearing different clothes. For those eagle-eyed listeners and eagle-eared listeners, that's how the PSUK sausage is made. Please enjoy. This is a fantastic conversation that I had with my old friend Pete.
So, you may or may not have seen in the news all the talks of the cuts to university jobs in the humanities, arts and social sciences, in what Hettenshaw, the chief executive of the British Academy, says is a crisis for higher education and a collective miscalculation in undervaluing these subjects. Even big AI companies have said that studying the humanities is going to be more important than ever, as these subjects contain ideas, philosophies and things that make us uniquely human, which, as a phrase, is not even vaguely terrifying. But let's backtrack a bit. And we have talked about this a couple of different times on the show, but this is just the latest in a series of threats facing universities. Immigration and visa changes in the UK have provoked a sharp fall in international student recruitment, losing the lucrative fees that universities had previously relied on for years. Frozen undergraduate fees for domestic students have not kept pace with inflation, while rising operating costs and expenses have forced many institutions to implement severe cost-cutting measures like closing courses and reducing staff. And it looks like it's the humanities that are being hit the hardest. The Guardian reported that in 1 year alone, nearly 4,000 academic posts in the social sciences, humanities and the arts have been axed. Plus, the number of students picking these subjects, both in school and higher education, has been on a downward trend for years. Now, the University of Exeter plans to cut 150 full-time posts, which is expected to fall disproportionately on the humanities, arts and social sciences. In response, leading writers, public figures and academics have supported a campaign to save these jobs, including Rory Stewart, Mark Kermode and the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. A petition decrying the proposed redundancies has received 30,000 signatures and counting. However, with the current state of higher education across the country, it can't just be left to famous people to stand up for the value of literature. We are now joined by Dr. Peter Riley, a member of the English and Creative Writing Faculty at Exeter University and union representative. Pete specialises in 19th century American literature, poetry and poetics, labour history and German-American culture. But he, in 2006 and 7, was also in a sketch comedy group with me. And so I think we can all just take a second to appreciate how funny it is that I've had to refer to him as Dr. Peter Riley through the entirety. And obviously, this is a very serious subject, and we want to talk about it in some detail. But first of all, Pete, good to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you again, Nish. Thanks for having me on.
How do you reflect on your time in university sketch comedy?
It was a long road to this particular conversation. Let's just say that. Nish, look, thank you so much for giving us this platform. It's really generous of you. And I you're right to point to this crisis, this broad sector-wide crisis. And seriously, solidarity to my colleagues at Cardiff, Nottingham, Sussex, Birmingham.
We spoke to Louisa Munch a couple of months ago on the show about this kind of crisis in higher education funding. And she also sort of drew attention to the same issue here, which is there is, in amongst all of the financial difficulties these institutions are facing, there is a kind of extraction of capital by a kind of managerial class. And that it feels like that it's sort of an unavoidable conversation topic when it comes to the spectre of job cuts.
Yeah, you know, I think that's right. And you say that there's a financial crisis. You spend the last 3 years doing that to your capital allocation within an institution. And then you turn around and start, you know, cutting the very subjects that your institutional reputation relies on. It's unbelievable. We are baffled by this decision. And I think it speaks to one of the reasons why so many people have got so upset. This is a very aggressive move, and we need to call it out.
115 of the 150 jobs in the Faculty of Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences are part of the plans to cut 150 jobs. So that's 115 of 150.
That's right.
70 language academics were among 500 staff that were told they were at risk of redundancy. And obviously this, the sort of chilling effect and the knock-on effect of all of this conversation is that A-level English literature numbers are falling. It was 83,000 in 2013. 10 years later, it's 54,000. You know, there is a disincentivization happening for people to study these subjects.
There is, but in the last year, actually, the numbers have ticked up. We've seen our admissions rates go up as well. So I don't think there's anything inevitable about this. And, you know, to say that as we lurch into this world of AI, like what more important question is going to emerge than what counts as a human being? What counts as humanity? Like, who is going to provide critical oversight for these technologies? Like, at precisely the moment that we need this kind of work doing in our society, they're coming and trying to axe it. I mean, I think we should all be interested in this. I think anyone who has a stake in basic values of what it means to live in a democratic society needs to stand up and help stop this.
What's the sort of broader picture of university cuts across the UK and what the government is demanding? You know, what are the kind of knock-on effects for universities and students? Why is it that when budgets are squeezed, it's the kind of delivery point of whatever the service, whether it's education or healthcare, mm-hmm. and not the managerial outlay that's squeezed?
Yeah. Can I just remind everyone that austerity is a choice. Capital allocation is a choice. And it's always in this age of austerity, which has lasted for so long now, it's always the frontline services that get cut first, right? And I mean, I am slightly heartened by the recent months, you know, the various kind of tax the rich campaigns, this sense that more people should contribute more. But I think honestly, Nish, we've got to stop destroying just the lovely, important, non-monetizable things in our society. Like, what are we going to have left? It's so easy to destroy these things. Very difficult to build them back up again. Like, let's stop with the austerity. And I mean, you ask, like, the broader governmental picture. Like, so Andy Burnham's just come in with his devolution strategy. And listen, I'm by no means an expert in devolutionary policy, but, like, cutting a major regional asset along these lines, that doesn't seem to particularly chime in with how best to do that.
There's a regional issue, but also I think the Guardian data has shown that the 4,000 jobs cut from social sciences, humanities and arts have overwhelmingly come from non-Russell Group universities. So there is this fear that the humanities become subjects that are preserved for elite educational institutions, which has a knock-on effect for wider society.
Absolutely. And listen, I'm really... This really speaks to the heart of the matter for me. Like, both of my parents were working class. And, you know, I was given this opportunity to do these subjects at university. And the idea that humanities, social sciences, like, become a kind of the preserve of the elite, become incredibly selective. I mean, this is to destroy so much potential, so many important voices. And we need to be worried. We need to be concerned.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a personal bugbear of mine that people sort of get very angry about Nepo babies in the arts, with, you know, and it's, you know, it's film, music, theatre, comedy, whatever. I sort of understand people's anger, but at the same time, I think you're angry with the wrong issue here. The systemic problems are the things we should be angry about. You know, the increasing sort of the increasing difficulty to make a living as an artist for a working class person is the reason that you're seeing the sort of prevalence and arise of Nepo babies. And being able to study the arts and humanities, like Coco and I talk about this all the time, you know, being able to study the arts and humanities have, for both of us and you, unlocked employment pathways that would have been closed off to us, you know, without the opportunity do an English and history degree. You know, maybe I'm not the person to make the case, because I imagine there's a lot of people going, well, actually, we could have done without your comedy, frankly. But
I tell you what, Nish, unlocked employment pathways is not a sentence that I ever thought I'd hear. Oh, it's all got very serious. I tell you what, like the early 2000s, they were a warm bath, weren't they? God, we didn't know what was coming.
Well, listen, let's talk about the early 2000s, because in some ways, some of the seeds of the problems that we're seeing now were sown then. So in 2004, students were paying £3,000 a year. That's actually the fees that you and I went to university on. And then that was tripled to £9,000 in 2012. But that increasing marketization of higher education in the last 20 years have meant that universities are run much more like businesses. Do you think that has a bearing on our current situation?
Oh, yeah. Like the culture that I have seen develop in the last few years as this university has started taking on the qualities and characteristics of a corporation have been genuinely toxic and chilling. You know, and it shuts horizons down. You know, that kid who would have otherwise done a history degree, an art history degree, suddenly with the debt mountain that a degree, a life-changing amount of money that a degree saddles you with, of course, you know, like you rightly ask the question, how do I instrumentalize this knowledge? How do I recoup that loss? How do I mitigate my relationship to debt? And that is horizon cancelling. That is horizon cancelling, and it's turning universities into something that I don't really recognize anymore. And this is just the latest step. It's got to the point now where the very idea of studying a humanities and social sciences degree at a major university is considered, I don't know, like not financially viable whatsoever, which is absolutely not true. But I can understand those basic pressures on my students. Of course I can. But yeah, the student fee structure changed something in the political economy of our intellectual life. And we are seeing the results right now.
We should talk about the students briefly as well, because the you know, all of this, the increased expenses that you incur to go to university, I mean, it must be frustrating for the students, because it must be sometimes unclear what they're paying for. A study by the Sutton Trust in 2023 found that one in four students regularly go without food and other necessities due to cost. And the report highlighted the impact of rising living expenses on student well-being.
So, Mish, for the last 18 months, I've been working as a director of student experience for my department. I've seen this play out firsthand. Our students are brilliant and motivated. And I tell you what, I mean, that the situation they find themselves in now is very different to what you and I found ourselves doing. And yeah, there is a lot of struggle and there's a lot of fear. And yet, you know, it's amazing to see, but the sense of solidarity, the sense of organization, the clarity that I see from my students is just breathtaking. It's a privilege to work in a department like this. But they are under particular strains, particular pressures. And listen, when a university turns around and basically says, no, cutting the departments by a third, that's devaluing the degree that they have spent or are spending life-changing amounts of money on. It's totally unacceptable.
And we're devaluing some subjects, right? We're devaluing the arts and humanities in place of sort of STEM subjects. And I guess, I know this is going to sound like a dumb question. I just don't understand, just as an external person. I mean, as someone who studied a humanities subject, surely the sort of costs associated with it are considerably lower. I mean, with the arts and humanities subject, you're talking about a teacher and some books, basically. Yeah. It doesn't make sense to me that if this is the way that you're going to save university funding.
I mean, we agree. The funding streams within a university are immensely complicated. But, you know, there have been times when the humanities have subsidized other departments. And perhaps now is a time when, you know, other departments can subsidize us. But I think we are cheap to run, and which is why the union is just turning around and making the point that, you know, what are you talking about? Like, why are you doing this outrageous, aggressive, preemptive cut? I think you're right, Nish. It's genuinely bewildering.
This again might sound terribly naive, but our new prime minister has an English degree. Are you sort of hopeful that maybe, you know, that you hopeful that this might make a difference?
If you're listening, Prime Minister Byrne, can you talk some sense into these people, please? Like, and the irony is as well, like, some of these people running us, making these decisions, they got English degrees as well.
Yeah.
It's like, they don't need to pull up the ladder. It's really obvious to so many of us that doing one of these degrees opens an extraordinary array of pathways. And you know what? Like, maybe when you're 18 years old, you don't necessarily know what you want to do. I mean, did you know what you wanted to do when you were 18? Well, you probably did.
Yeah, well, I'm a bad example.
I
narrowed my own horizons, Pete.
Yeah, you did. You did. But I did. I didn't know. And, like, you know, the pressure that we put on students to, like, know exactly what they're going to do at 18 years old. Well, maybe give them a chance to stop being assessed to death, take on some ideas, have conversations with each other, think about other ways of being in the world, think about other ways that aren't immediately relatable to the marketplace. And on that basis, then make a decision about how to contribute to society. Because it's not a conveyor belt. Like, yeah. A university is a place where ideas ought to flourish. And this turn is towards something very different and very frightening.
I agree with you, and I feel very strongly about this. And this podcast feels very strongly about these issues, you know, because it's actually easy for me to talk about Coco in her absence. But Coco will often, you know, Coco's a great example of somebody who, you know, was raised in a single parent household and, yeah, you know, grew up working class in East London. And education kind of opened pathways to her, and her humanities, she always credits her humanities degree as something that has opened up, you know, an incredible professional life for her. I would also say studying English and history for me is like a key reason that I was able to, go into comedy. And I mean, even if we only count these things in terms of, you know, money, it definitely worked out pretty well for the exchequer. I can tell you that. It's worked out very nicely for the exchequer. Thank you very much. You're definitely
Absolutely.
In profit on me.
The thing is that a balance sheet shouldn't necessarily, yeah, like, you know, make its decisions on 12 months down the line, 18 months down, yeah, the line, right? You make an investment and you see where it goes, because the dividend might be 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. Not that it's all about the dividend,
yeah,
but how incredibly short-sighted. Like, of course this is going to pay off in various ways, in, you know, financial, cultural, social, spiritual capital, like, in years that we can't see yet. But let's not turn, yeah, the tap off.
Yeah.
That's absolutely ridiculous. Like, this is proper destructive short-termism. We need to keep our horizons open. Now,
And so in the short term, what happens next? What's the next kind of phase of this?
Well, there have been votes of no confidence in the vice chancellor, the university executive board, the pro vice chancellor of humanities and social sciences. Really, I'm genuinely astonished that they haven't resigned. They should resign. We're working up to balloting for strike action is what we're doing, because, you know, we're a union, and that's what our leverage is. I hope it doesn't come to that. I really don't. There is time for these people to recognize the mistake that they have made and that they are making, and to row back on this. But listen, we are currently balloting for strikes.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, right. And in terms for our listeners, what's a sort of takeaway you'd like, you know, listeners who are maybe working in higher education or in higher education themselves, what's a kind of takeaway you'd like to leave them with in terms of how the kind of future for arts and humanities and what it actually means for the tertiary education sector as a whole?
I just think the fight we're having at Exeter, you can see the dynamics playing out very clearly. And I think if we lose this one, we all lose. And I said it before, like, solidarity to all of my wonderful, brilliant colleagues at Nottingham, Sussex, Cardiff, who are at various stages of this. Let's stick together and let's resist. And, you know, for anyone else listening to this, particularly students, particularly people who have these degrees and people who don't have these degrees, this is a keystone. This is fundamental to what our society is. We don't want to live in a world without thinkers and critical thinkers and creative writers and people who hold power to account. That's what our subject does. It holds power to account. And if that is extinguished, imagine the long-term cost. It's frightening. Let's stop this. Let's stop this now. Sign the petition. And let's make our voice heard and move against this because it's unacceptable.
A link to the Instagram page and the petition will be in our show notes. And all that's left for me to do is to say, Dr. Peter Riley, thank you very much. And it was, as always, a pleasure to speak to you.
Nish, thank you very much for this platform. Really appreciate it.
That was me talking to Dr. Peter Riley, who was sharing his views on the proposed job cuts. We're a professional outfit here, so we reached out to Exeter University for comment, and here is what they had to say. We fully understand that this is a worrying time for those affected by the ongoing consultation process. However, it is important to stress and reiterate that these are just proposals at this stage. While Exeter remains in a strong position, rising costs, the real terms decline in tuition fee income, underfunded research and a sustained drop in international student demand mean we must take action now. These changes are intended to secure the university's long-term sustainability, to protect our teaching and research excellence and ensure our activities remain aligned with future priorities. So that's the right to reply from the university. You are at liberty to make up your own mind how you feel about it.
We've been working hard to bring you a special YouTube exclusive on Gaza, particularly the UK government scheme to evacuate Gazan students with offers to study at UK universities.
Crucially, it's not an emergency podcast. Why is that? Because everyone who works on the show knows, and everyone who listens to the show knows, I fucking hate the phrase emergency podcast. That is a tautology. No emergency has ever been resolved by the existence of a podcast. Do not ever, if somebody says emergency podcast, you have my permission to tell them to go fuck themselves. Even if it's mateless. This is a bonus conversation that we had this week that we really want to share. You can watch the full episode on YouTube, but here is a little preview as we chat with student Mahmoud Hassanen and actor Siobhan McSweeney. I want to talk more about the auction, but do you think this should be up to, should this be the way that we're funding this scheme? Like, it doesn't seem correct, right, that we're sort of auctioning off football shirts and stuff when it feels like this is something we should be, this should be a fully funded governmental program, it feels.
Thanks for asking. Before I answer, can I curse?
Yes.
Yes,
of course.
Please, encourage.
Of course it fucking shouldn't. It shouldn't be up to a few gobshites that you know off the television to be doing the basic humanitarian obligation that any democratic free state pertains to be. We should be doing so much more. Okay, I'm getting wound up. I said I wouldn't get wound up.
There's two things that we encourage on this podcast, Siobhan. It's swearing and getting wound up. So you're fine.
Like, right. You're in a safe space.
Yeah, you could not be in a safer space right now.
It's an incredible achievement to get into any university, let alone doing it in the midst of a genocide where, you know, water, electricity, medical aid's been cut off. Can you just tell me what it was like? Even just the, how did you even do your application?
We had no electricity, no water, not even a stable Wi-Fi connection. So I took my phone, I went to a cliff, to the highest cliff in our city. Wow. And I used to raise my hand all the way in the air just to catch a Wi-Fi signal in order for me to go online, get all the data required from me and documents in order for me to go back home, fill in the application and everything on a candle, because obviously there's no electricity.
Wow.
And yeah, eventually we got there.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to PodSave the UK.
PodSave the UK is an Intelligence Squared production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer Esme Ash, digital producer Chelsea Nyamkwingita, and assistant producer Verity Dakala.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Our executive producers are Bea Duncan and Katie Long.
Join us next week for a special mailbag episode where we answer some of your burning questions. After that, we're taking a break for a week and we'll be back on the 20th of August.
Not me. I'll be up in Body, Scotland. It says in the script here, please do a Scottish accent. I'm not going to do that, producers. Okay? You're not gonna get me on that because my accent work is frankly awful. I'll be doing the Edinburgh Fringe and I'll be leaving the pod in Coco's capable hands. And she'll be joined as co-host by a friend of the pod, Cody Dala, to make sense of the Clacton by-election mess and the fallout and the possibility of another Clacton by-election.
It's going to be fun, fun, fun. So we'll see you then. And don't forget to keep in touch with us. You can email podsavetheuk@crooked.com and you can follow us. We're at PodsaveTheUK on Instagram, TikTok, X and Blue Sky. We are everywhere. Remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays too.
Keep it, listeners. Louis Fertel here. I have something I've been dying to get off my chest. Dr. Robbie is the real villain of The Pitt. There, I said it. Okay, but that's not actually the big news. Here's the big news. Emmy-nominated television host Nita Parker is officially the new co-host of Keep It. Woo-hoo. That's the confession. The Dr. Robbie thing was just, you know, me needing to say it somewhat out loud.
Okay, shots fired, and I hear you're Dr. Robbie, and I raise you. Sex in the City wasn't really a show about finding love. It was a humiliation ritual on bad friendships. The clothes were cute, though.
Oh, yeah, the you tutu know? In the opening credits,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, it's really cute.
Every week, Nina and I will bring you an inside look at all the pop culture drama, the hottest takes you can handle, and honestly, maybe some you can't. Plus, celebrity guests galore.
We're going to guide you through gorgeous wreckage of pop culture. We are unpacking the biggest stories in TV, film, entertainment news. We're going to go all the way to Gen Z, from YouTube taking over the horror genre to Olivia Rodrigo redefining pop music. And then we're going to also talk about maybe you partying with Madonna a little bit.
Oh yeah, that one time at the Abbey. It was sweaty. But in a good way. New episodes drop every Wednesday on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts.